You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. We're going pretty off format this week, given that we don't have a movie and a movie to compare it to. We've instead got a whole lot of movies because we saw a whole lot of movies in 2022. And it's traditional to round up what we want to recognize, what we most appreciated, what we most loved in the year gone by. So I'm here with
Scott Tobias,
Keith Phipps.
Genevieve bowed out of this one because she, as a TV editor, has watched so much more TV than movies in the past year or so. But that may come up again when we talk a little bit more about, TV that we loved, just not on this episode. So this is just going to be a one-off and a pretty informal sort of thing where we discuss our top 10 movies of 2022. To avoid this being a six-hour episode, we're going to kind of brisk across our bottom five. We each have a top 10 that we generated. You guys did yours for the reveal, I assume.
Yes, by the time this publishes, we will have had this out on the reveal.
Yeah, I was wondering why I hadn't seen that yet. Did you like write up separate lists or do any kind of like combined list? How did that work?
We're doing separate lists. And I think one nice thing about running our own publication is that we can take our time and like not rush to have everything watched by the first week of December. So I've been watching stuff and like I did a ranked list here. This is not publishing anywhere, but I have a ranked list of just for my own personal use of like 50 plus films. I think were quite good, easy to recommend, or at least have a quality to them from this year. I'm not going to read all 50. But I will say the bottom was Cat Video Fest 2022, which was a very enjoyable time at the movies, but perhaps not something that the year will be remembered for.
And where can people watch Cat Video Fest 2022 if they want?
I saw it at the Music Box. It's a traveling oscilloscope is behind it, and it's an annual collection of cat videos that kind of rotate in some keep some greatest hits, rotate in some new ones every year. They did a dog video fest for the first time this year, but I did not make it to that one. But we've been going off and on to Cat Video Fest for years now.
Well, as much as I would like, I mean, maybe for the next episode, we'll bump our planned pairing and replace it with Keith Phipps ranks all of the Cat Video Fests from previous years.
Yeah.
Or just put that on the reveal. I'd like to see that. I also had to do a top 10 for Polygon.com, but they wanted they set the deadline on that crazy early, like in late November. And yeah. I protested mightily because there were so many films that hadn't had critics screenings yet. But they said, we can just continue to bump it over time. So I continued to sneak films in. But as it happened, my top five really didn't shift much from the cramming session that I did immediately before the deadline. So I'm pretty good there, and I'm pretty happy with what I ended up with. But some of the films I saw in like the last week before we were told to turn it a top 10 definitely did end up on this list, which is very different from yours. But we will get into that. Why don't we kick off with, we're just going to blitz past our bottom five. Keith, let's start with you. What's the bottom half of your top 10 list for 2022 look like?
I'm going from 10 to 6. I've got Turning Red, very fine Pixar film. I think one of the best films they've done in a while. Saint-Omer, which is one of those films that falls into this gray area where it technically is a 2022 release, but people aren't going to really see it until early 2023. But it's a really great French courtroom drama about a mother who kills her child and this a novelist who becomes kind of obsessed with the case. I won't do it justice by that description. There's a lot going on about French culture and immigration and what it is to be of African descent in France and so on and so forth. But anyway, hopefully we can get into that more some other time. It's a really good film. Banshees of Inisherin, which I think we'll probably be talking about later. All the Beauty and Bloodshed, the great documentary about Nan Golden, and Decision to Leave, which I also suspect we'll be touching on later, a really inventive and haunting modern noir by Park Chan-wook.
That's a really diverse selection of bottom five, I gotta say. You've got a doc, a like roughly 3-hour mood piece, a Pixar animated film, whatever you want to describe Banshees of Inisherin as, and a French courtroom drama. That's just quite the set of films.
I found it was a lot easier. Like, not that I ever really tailor my list to, like, you know, fill all the slots, but I found, like, this year I was able to, like, you know, put a bunch of different types of films in my top 10, top 15, without really, like, you know, bending to include things. Which is good. I think it's a sign of a healthy film culture when you have that many different types of films floating around.
Yeah, for 2022, I think I was less influenced by the December influx of prestige movies than possibly I ever have been at any point in my film career. Scott's nodding, but not vocalizing.
I kind of agree with you. There was a lot of the big sort of white elephant movies that came out late in the year were flawed. Were very flawed. In fact, it was kind of a little bit of an off year for me. I don't know why. I look at my list. It's not like I obviously like the films on my list quite a bit, but my number one film would probably have been my number 8 film of last year. So like I kind of had a little bit of a struggle finding films that just I really loved this year. So I don't know what to say about that, but I still plenty of films to like and discuss here for sure.
Yeah, I don't know that I had as much of a struggle to find films that I loved, but I definitely did not love our films of December. Usually make up a big chunk of the decision, and did not this time.
Empire of Light is not your number one film of the year, Tasha. Is that what you're saying?
Empire of Light, not my number one film of the year. Babylon, somehow, not my number one film of the year. We talked about Babylon in high detail over on the Patreon. We had a lot to say about that film because that film was a lot. There's a whole lot going on there.
It's just so flawed. You can't really put it on a list like this. I appreciate. It's a big swing. I appreciate the big swing, though. At least it made an impression. At least
that said, it's a film I definitely will revisit. There's a lot of fascinating stuff in that movie.
Well, what did you find, if not unflawed, at least less flawed? If not lovable, at least more lovable, Scout. What's your bottom five look like?
My bottom five, I had to include my beloved Confess Fletch in my top 10. Just one of those classic number 10s. Decision to Leave is my number 9. The Terrence Davies film Benediction, quite a beautiful film. That's a number 8. Number 7 is Donkey. You got to have a good Donkey film on there that isn't Shrek. It's EO. And then my number 6 is All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. The Nan Golden doc was my favorite documentary of 2022.
Despite both of you recommending it, I did not get to All the Beauty and the Bloodshed before the deadline. It ended up in both of your bottom five lists. What do you both love so much about this movie?
Well, she's just a towering figure, Nan Golden. She's just been involved in so much of the New York art scene and also the political scene throughout her life. It is a film that it ends up being, you know, the live footage, I suppose, that we get of her has to do with her action against a very effective action against the Sackler family and about taking the Sackler name off of all of the museums and exhibits and stuff that they threw their name on there because of her. You know, she was she was got addicted to OxyContin and the opioids and barely survived that ordeal and used her name and her fame to really, you know, have an impact on the way that the public understood the Sackler family, which had kept its name, you know, out of the discussion of Purdue Pharma and OxyContin quite effectively for a long time, while keep putting its name all over, you know, every art museum, you can imagine through their philanthropic arm. So all that was very interesting. But you can see a history of all kinds of things about her involvement in ACT UP and her relationships with all of the major modern artists in the New York scene, you know, and then you just get a glimpse of her art and her life. It's just a really full portrait of a major, major artist. And I think it has a lot of power, particularly in the last, you know, it's got a lot of closing speed.
Yeah, right. Because there's a lot of, you know, you get a little bit of her background and you get a little bit of her artistic career and you get a little bit of her activism, and Director Laura Poitras kind of flits between one and the other, but you realize it all kind of, you know, he comes together in the end. It is, and it's all part of this one life. It's a remarkable film.
Yeah, Scott, I'm also a little surprised by Confess Fletch on your list. This is a real outlier for you. You're generally a very serious master shot Taiwanese cinema type fan, and less likely to show up with a John Hamm comedy mystery sort of thing on your top tens. What about this movie grabbed you so much?
I like fun. I'm a fun person. I think. This is an example of a movie just nailing the assignment, because I think it's been so frustrating to watch the way this film has been kind of dumped, I guess, by the studio, is that I think it just does everything that it's supposed to do. If the idea is let's take this piece of IP and revive it, I just don't know how you do it better than this. It's John Hamm is perfectly cast as Fletch. I mean, it stays true to the spirit of the books. It's got Kyle MacLachlan as a, you know, as an art dealer / EDM enthusiast. It's cast all the way through with really funny actors. The tone is just perfectly light. It's just a pure pleasure. And I think it's frustrating to me in a way, because it's just like, this is exactly the movie that you would want out of a Fletch, you know, revival, and it just, you know, it kind of didn't have the cultural impact that it should have had. So I think it's a pleasure, and it's the type of movie that if it were just, you know, back in the day when I would be flipping around cable, if it was something that kind of popped up, I would just keep it on, because it's just that kind of breezy pleasure, and I felt like I wanted it to have a place on my list for that reason.
It's troubling that it's the kind of that this sort of film, doesn't seem to be a place for it anymore. When there ought to be, it's highly entertaining. It is, it is not filled with CGI effects or whatever. But you know, there's a time when popular movies didn't have to be, and this is kind of a throwback to that in some ways. And I guess it was a throwback that I think it's a growing cult, though. I feel like they're the people who love it and spread the word. And every once in a while on Twitter, I'll see like a new outpouring of love for Confess Fletch as more people find it. And I hope that continues.
Yeah, I just disagree that there isn't a place for this kind of film anymore. It seems like the place for this kind of film is on streaming and social media. Like, that film has had a surprisingly long tail in terms of people finding it and loving it, in terms of film Twitter, writing about it and examining it, in terms of just, you know, revival. It doesn't have a place in theaters anymore.
Yeah.
And that's usually what people mean when they say there's no place for this kind of thing. They mean there's no place for this kind of thing as a major studio project with a guaranteed 3-month theatrical window. But, you know, that so many movies like this hit streaming and then the audience finds it and talks about it incessantly because they want other people to see it. And I feel like Confess Fletch was maybe one of the bigger hits like that of the year in terms of, you know, people spreading the word about it and not saying that it was a barn-burning movie or it should have made $1 billion worldwide like Avatar, but, you know, that it's there and you can watch it and it's fun and you shouldn't miss it.
I mean, I hope you're right. I mean, Mottola wants to make another Fletch movie. Has written a script, I believe, for it. So if it is, I don't know. The numbers are so hard to even like understand. So I don't know what a hit even is. I mean, I know, you know, in our little bubble, it is. I'm with you, Tasha. It has gotten some attention. But I don't know what that equals. It's so weird the way all of this works. So you know, maybe there's a reason for optimism that this thing could, that this version of Fletch could get another run. I'd be on board.
Yeah, this is sort of a weird sideline, but I mean, it used to be that people in our industry both obsessively followed a box office and decried people for equating box office with success.
Yeah.
You know, we did not want the movie that made the most money to be the winner of everything in any contest. We didn't want people to be so obsessed with how much money a movie made. But at the same time, all of that information was so tracked and so visible that it was pretty easy to tell where a movie succeeded and was just destined to spawn sequels and, you know, spinoffs and copycats. And in an environment like this, it's like, I don't know, it's not even just the viewership that constitutes a success. It's like, what's the economics of the specific streaming service that that commissioned this? How much word of mouth is worth it to them to continue trying to pay John Hamm to do movies? It's all kind of a big question mark.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, this is almost like the cursed monkey paw version of me kind of wishing that we'd obsess less about box office. Now it just feels like we don't know what's going on at all with the industry. That's as frustrating as all of overly obsessing about the numbers. So Tasha, yep. I'm now curious about you and your bottom five or your 10 through 6 is a better way of putting it rather than
bottom
5.
Yeah, my 10 through 6 is actually the number 10 on my list is another kind of good example of how weird and opaque the industry's gotten. I'll just do the quick run through 10 through 6. Number 10 is Cyrano, the Joe Wright musical with Peter Dinklage as Cyrano de Bergerac. Number 9 is Robert Eggers' The Northman. Number 8 is Banshees of Inisherin. Number 7 is Roman Gavras's Athena, which popped up on Netflix. Kind of the Warner heavy technical brio having movie about an uprising in a French banlieue over the death of a child in police violence. And number 6 is Gina Prince-Bythewood's The Woman King. Looping back to number 10 is Cyrano. This is another movie. This one just seemed to go under everybody's radar.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because its release was such a weird question mark. If you look on the IMDb, it's considered a 2021 film because it played film festivals in 2021. And then it got a 1 week, one theater screening in December 2021 for awards purposes. But it actually came out in theaters in the US, at least in February. And yet it didn't seem like it was on anybody's lists. Nobody noticed.
Yeah, I hate that gray area. Like Petite Maman might be on my list for this year because it's technically a 2021 film, and like we're gonna run into that next year. With, I think, you know, with some other films,
Yeah, that sucks.
Well, Saint-Omer seemed like it could be that situation for me.
Saint-Omer, there's a film coming out called Return to Seoul, which is really a quite good film. I think people are going to be talking about, but it's technically going to be a 2022 film. But yeah.
We had the same problem with The Worst Person in the World, which, you know, a year ago kind of came out in that weird dead zone. And we put it at Polygon, we put it on our best of 2021 list. And then it turned up on a bunch of 2022 lists. And it's like every publication is going to have its own call in terms of, do you go with the wide release, the theatrical date? That's another way that the industry has gotten weird and opaque is, when does a film come out, technically? If a film plays in one theater for 1 minute in December for awards purposes, does that actually count as a 2022 film or a 2021 film? If nobody else in the world can see it, did it really come out? If a tree falls in the forest, can it get an Oscar, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's frustrating. And I'm glad you have it on there. It is conceptually interesting movie for sure because it is a musical, but I think it's really effective. It worked. It worked for me too. I thought it kind of should have gotten a little bit more critical acclaim or attention than it got.
That and Athena are films I haven't seen, so I'll have to see. I'll have to catch up with both of them.
Athena is my number one regret now. I can't believe I haven't seen it, because it seems like it'd be completely up my alley, and I might have to like squeeze it in before submitting my reveal list tomorrow, because I've heard so many great things, and now here it is on Tasha's list.
From your list, Benediction is the one I need to get to, but you know, well, there's still time, right?
I don't know.
Athena is one of those movies that you may spend half of the movie just regretting you're not seeing it in a theater on the big screen. It's so big. I mean, I don't know how long that opening oneer is. It might be 8 or so minutes long. One of the things that I still haven't gotten around to seeing is Netflix immediately put out a behind the scenes, like how we did this, you know, because the single shot sequences are, you know, up there with some of the biggest ones we've seen in cinema over the years in terms of complexity and camera ambition. And then there's a lot of Children of Men style. Okay, that camera just like went through a building or went through a car. Like, how the hell are they doing this? But like on top of that, it's one of those things I can actually hear Mike D'Angelo like steaming somewhere over the acclaim that this film's gotten, because he's just so down on
the single take
yeah. shot.
Yeah.
And it getting attention. But it has gotten a lot of attention with Athena. But at the same time, Athena is just full of intense performances and really big emotions and just a really important issue. And it's fascinating to me kind of how it rides the line between understanding the very, very end of it, post-credits, I have some big questions about. But up until that moment, it really kind of rides the line of, are people in an uprising, in a straight up riot situation as a protest? They're doing a lot of damage and they're harming a lot of people, but they're also resisting a situation. Again, police killing a child that, you know, maybe requires this kind of anger, this kind of expression, this kind of attention getting stunned. And I'm not sure that the film has a lot of answers in terms of, is there a right or wrong here? Is there a solution? Is there a way out? It's just a presentation of emotion and where it gets you. And, you know, I tend to love that kind of thing in film. Speaking of things we love in film, you guys ready to get into your top five?
Woohoo, let's go.
Let's do it.
Let's start with you, Keith. What's your number five for 2022?
My number five film for the year is Nope, Jordan Peele's third film as a director, and a film that arrived shrouded in a lot of mystery and like played shrouded in a lot of mystery. I mean, I've seen this film several times now, and I do see a new connection each time. I'm probably repeating something else I've said else before, and I'll say again at some point, but like Get Out is such a wonderful, clear metaphor, beautifully executed. And I think like with Us and Nope, Peele's gotten a little more opaque in ways that make those films really fascinating to think about and watch. And just technically, it's just a beautifully executed thriller that begins as a, without spoiling too much if you haven't seen it, begins as a kind of, you know, alien invasion film and kind of ends as Jaws in a way. There's a lot going on here about race and showbiz, but it's also just a kind of rip-roaringly exciting thriller about some misfits banding together to fight some unknown force that's stranger than they ever could have ever reckoned. A great time at the movies for me.
Nope was not a lister for me because I think it ended up being too flawed. I think it's trying to do so many different things and some of those things conflict with each other. But I think I thought about that movie more than any other movie that I've seen this year. I think I came back like mentally to some of the images of it. We did a list at Polygon of scenes of the year. And for me, the blood rain in the house is just one of the most indelible sequences of 2022. The horror of it and the mystery and the confusion, but also just the incredible way it's shot. there's so many images in that film that just lingered with me for months, and so many questions that I kept thinking about. I think it's one of the year's most intriguing films, even if I didn't personally think it was one of the year's best.
Yeah, I'm 100% with Tasha. I just like to say that sometimes when that, on the rare occasion that it happens.
Just for variety.
Yeah, everything that Tasha just said about Nope, I'm on board with.
Scott, what is your number five?
My number five is After Yang, the Koganada film that we discussed way, way back in early 2022. And really for any film, that's the one thing about doing these lists is that the further away you get from some of these films, the less likely they seem to appear on the list. But this one stuck with me. This is a story about a future in which a very human-like robot companion dies right after the film opens, or malfunctions, has a terrible malfunction, and a father tries to get it fixed and can't really be fixed. So it's about the journey, and it's an immensely moving film, philosophically loaded, and particularly meaningful to say non-believers such as myself who really value life on Earth. I mean, it's a film about the value of a life and what it means, and how you kind of break it down into to component parts in this case. It's quite lovely. It's the type of thoughtful, you know, emotional science fiction that you like to see. So that's my number five.
I feel like we don't need to dive into After Yang too much, given that we did an entire episode about that one, pairing it with AI. I want to say AI, the extraterrestrial. Steven Spielberg's AI. But that still remains one of my favorite episodes that we did all year in terms of kind of picking that film apart and analyzing some very elliptical storytelling that's just very powerful and very well done. And it still remains a kind of Next Picture Show all-timer for me, in that I think it's the only time we've had three different people on the show get slightly choked up while trying to talk about a movie.
I was thinking about that. I'd be curious. I wonder if that would be if Genevieve were on the pod, if that would be her number one film, because she had a particularly strong reaction to it. We'll never know.
We can ask her, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, we can ask her. We have access. Tasha, what about you? What's your number five?
My number five is Inuo, which is a Japanese anime movie by the director of Ride Your Wave, Lou Over the Wall, Mind Game. And this is a person who makes just really unusual anime films. The characters have very little to do with the traditional kind of, big-eyed, colorful-haired characters in so much anime. In this case, it's a sort of historical epic set 600 years ago about a young boy, shall we say, touched by the spirits, and a blind monk who come together and kind of form the world's first rock and roll band. It's, again, a very impressionistic story. It's made to kind of reflect how changing regimes alter history by refusing to tell certain stories or telling stories in certain ways. But it expresses it as this just kind of creative musical explosion as these two outcasts come together and start singing these wild songs about a group of Japanese warriors who lost battles and therefore their stories have been erased, and come under the attention of the ruling regime, who wants to stamp these stories out. It is another one of those, oh God, why didn't I see this on the big screen when I had the chance movies? It's just gorgeous. And the music is weird and strange and evocative. Long, long periods of this this musical movie are just dedicated to performances of these story songs and the growing fanatical audience around them. But it's both an ambitious story in terms of the ideas at play, and just a playful one in terms of the incredibly strange visuals. I really loved this film. I was very, very taken with it.
I confess to not being aware of it. So this is a good chance for it. So where can people see it? Can people see it now? somewhere?
Yeah, it's available digitally. It's yet another release from G-Kids, the New York animation outlet that picked up all of Studio Ghibli's output and kind of gently took it away from
quality with G-Kids.
Exactly. But they took it away from Disney and basically did way, way better subtitling and voiceover with it than Disney had done and gave it more of a platform.
That's good.
And then, you know, they're making sure that those movies get seen on like HBO Max, for instance. But yeah, G-Kids, I just follow them pretty religiously because they bring in animation from around the world. They do really high quality dubs and subs, translations, and they're just incredible curators of amazing animation. And this was their latest. So yeah, that's me. Inuo, number five. Keith, looping back to you for your number four.
It's a film you might have heard of called After Yang, which we've covered pretty extensively. I'll just say, very good film. Maybe you can move on from there, I guess.
Yeah, we Keith and I have a bit of a Borg thing happening with our top five, unfortunately.
Your top fives are very similar, but in different orders.
I'm throwing mine out. I'm number one film of the year is 3,000 Years of Longing. Let's say that.
Did you just subtract 1,000 years? Did you just call it 2,000 years of longing?
No, I called it 3,000 years. Okay, it probably just came out of my mouth. Okay.
Oh, I had such hopes for that movie.
I like it. It's my top 50 of the year.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things on your top 50 of the year. I would say up to 50 movies on that list.
I mean, it's still Cat Video Fest 2022, but it's something.
Keith is the only person to not threaten to break into tears on our After Yang podcast.
I choked up during the AI portion of that, so it's fine. You know, I just
got yours in.
That's a film I've seen it a couple of times now. You know, it is one I would easily watch again. I found you know, it's not a film that goes out of its way to connect the dots for you in some ways, and I find that part of its pleasures is you know, putting together some of the connections between characters there and the subtleties of the relationships, and it's one where I find myself thinking about the scenes like the tea scene and moments like that. It's a lovely film, a thought provoking one as well.
I am pretty curious how it would play on a second viewing. Virtually nothing on my list is something that I got to see a second time.
Yeah.
And that movie in particular, a lot of the emotional impact for me was in some surprise elements of it. And then a lot of the mystery of it for me was not knowing whether they're ever going to actually recover this friend of theirs, this family member of theirs. So being able to see it a second time and just like live in sequences like the tea scene, I think would be a very different experience.
I should say we should want more of the opening of After Yang and the closing credits of White Noise. More of that stuff.
More dancing, basically, is what you're talking about.
More fun, because those are two awesome sequences.
Fair enough. Scott, what is your number four?
My number four is The Fablements by a filmmaker you may have heard of named Steven Spielberg. This was one of a number of films under kind of the prevailing theme for me. After Sun is another, After Armageddon Time is the third, which are all about movies in which filmmakers reflect on childhood memories or moments in childhood that they understand differently as adults than they really comprehended at the time. I think there's a richness to The Fablemans. I think it's important that Spielberg has both made it now as this late in his career, and that he's also worked with Tony Kushner on the screenplay. It feels like a real challenge to him to really confront this piece of his past. It's not just purely a nostalgia piece, though it is that. It is also about understanding what that adults are complicated and have relationships that are not sometimes not easy to understand or approve of, and you know, and there's even moments in the film where Spielberg is reflecting on moments that he doesn't even understand, even in the movie. Even the movie doesn't. I think about the Senior Skip Day movie that he makes, where he makes his chief bully into a kind of hero, and I don't even think the film has it sorted out why he does that. It's just there for us to kind of process. It's just kind of true. So all of that's wonderful, and it does work also as sort of a tribute to the movies and as a love letter to the movies. That part of it is also quite affecting. And then you have that incredible, you know, David Lynch as John Ford capper as well. So the Fablemans I loved, and that was my number four. Tasha, what is your number four?
I think we'll come back to the Fablemans in just a moment. But before that, my number four is Decision to Leave, which turned up on both of your bottom lists. And mm-hmm. we didn't discuss it at the time specifically because we knew it was coming up. Park Chan-wook has just been a fascination of mine forever. I love his work. This movie is one of a number on my 2022 lists that's there as much as for construction as anything else. It's, man, the unfolding of this movie and the ongoing question of what is this story about? It seems to be about a whole bunch of things. Oh, no, it's kind of about one thing. But it takes a really long time to see that. And then it hits you all at once what this movie is doing. I love that in a film. Decision to Leave, also a movie that we profiled on the show and talked about at great length. So maybe don't need to dive into, you know, why we love it. But yeah, maybe after Nope, this is probably the movie that I thought most about in 2022 in terms of all of the different threads and how they pull together and just moments kind of recurring in my mind as I slowly sort of piece together, oh, that's why this is there. That's why we keep recurring this particular concept or this particular conceit or this particular conversation. And talking to Park Chan-wook about the symbolism in this film, probably my favorite interview I did in 2022.
This and Nope, I suppose, are two of the films I feel like most inclined to revisit just because and you mentioned them being two that you thought about a lot, and I think it's just, I just think there's a lot to sort out in these movies. I didn't feel like I fully got it. And my worry, of course, is that I'll see both of them again and be like, why did I not rank them higher on my list? What, you know, I should have trusted that these filmmakers know what they're doing, and that I just needed to kind of catch up. And but I mean, there's no doubting that Decision to Leave has that impeccable style too. I mean, that he has gotten, you know, beginning of his career, I mean, I always liked him, but there was kind of this very showy operatic quality to his early work, which again is quite good. I mean, I like the Vengeance trilogy quite a bit, but I think lately there's a level of subtlety and sophistication that he's added to his work. I mean, he's matured, I think, as a filmmaker, and I think you can see that, you know, in Decision to Leave.
Yeah, there's such a confidence the way he plays with the editing of it, the way he plays with, like, twisting, you know, offering unexpected twists on familiar noir elements and, you know, police procedural elements and the way I feel like it's a film that kind of keeps emotion at arm's length until it, like, lets that arm down and lets the emotion come rushing in at the end. Yeah, I think it's a remarkable film.
Yeah, and a part of that maturity process has been kind of slowing down, spending more time in contemplation instead of frenetic action. You know, I will never not love Old Boy and its frenetic action and its extreme violence. None of this is to in any way insult his older work or say that, you know, this is better. Thank goodness he's grown up and grown out of that phase. They were just very different phases for recognizing, recognizably the same filmmaker. And, you know, I love that he's, instead of trying to just recreate what he did when he was a younger man, he's kind of just taken it into a new form and a new format. And I love that for him. Keith, what's your number three?
My number three film is The Fablemans, which I think you're kind of onto something where some of the most interesting films of the years are the ones that kind of present these puzzle elements that kind of gel together as the film progresses. I think that's true of you know, the decision to leave and so on and so forth. But I think with the Fablemans is very explicit with that, where the favorite scene maybe of the year is the editing sequence where the young Sammy is putting together a film of his family's camping trip and comes to realize that, you know, that the evidence there is of what's going on with his family that he didn't notice is there on film, and he chooses to put together an alternate history, and it, there's just a lot going on there with the way stories are told, the way film tells stories, and I just found it a remarkably moving film as well. I was a little skeptical at the idea of Spielberg doing an autobiographical film. He's not that kind of filmmaker. At least I didn't think of him as such, but I think the way he dug into his own history, connected it to the history of film and his own love of filmmaking, it was all, you know, really nicely done, and a film. I this one I did not get a chance to revisit, but I look forward to revisiting it at some point.
Scott, what about you? What do you have at number three?
Yeah, so my number three is The Banshees of Inisherin. This is the new Martin McDonagh movie, reuniting him with Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson. You know, the team that did it in Bruges, we did a pairing on those two as well, and it was really great to see them both together. This is a very entertaining film. It's got the McDonagh dialogue. It's got that great chemistry between the two stars, but it's also quite bleak and sort of heartbreaking at its core. It's a film about a friendship that just ends for what seems like no reason, but it isn't no reason. It's Brendan Gleeson's character just decides that this guy, part of his daily routine that he's been drinking pints and shooting the shit with every day, like, he doesn't want to talk to him anymore. He's not a person of substance. He only has so much time left. And then of course, that is incomprehensible to his friend. This is an island that is extremely well evoked, both visually and dramatically. Performances are wonderful across the board, including Barry Keoghan as a very sad little misfit boy. And Kerry Condon as Colin Farrell's sister, who kind of starts to eye the mainland as maybe a more substantial place for her to go. Yeah, there's a lot here, and I think it's a real good comeback film for McDonagh. It's really sort of him at his best. So that's my number three.
We should probably pause here to just note what a remarkable year for Colin Farrell it was, and what range he has in across the two films we've already talked about, and of course The Batman, where he's a lot of fun and very big, and a very big performance that has nothing that's unlike either of the other two performances we've talked about. I also love that Colin Farrell, one of the handsomest people alive. You know, you can cast him convincingly as the village dullard in Banshees, and it works for some reason. I guess he's also in 13 Lives. I didn't even think about that, but that one.
That's not a bad film too. The 13 Lives.
It's a big year for Colin Farrell.
Yeah, he's wonderful. I mean, I think he's just could do anything, right? I mean, he can give you he can do drama, he can do comedy. He has that kind of star magnetism, but he's also kind of approachable and fun. I mean, in on top of anything else, I mean, just aside from the movie stuff, he's one of the most fascinating interviews. I had a conversation with him once. I can't remember what it was about, what piece I was writing, but I could just listen to this guy talk all day. He's just such a thoughtful guy. He's the greatest gift that Joel Schumacher ever brought to to cinema, in my opinion, is when Schumacher cast him in Tigerland, and Farrell's career kind of took off from there, because he's really something.
It's also just kind of remarkable to see him in so many films in a year, like for quite a while there. I think around the time of In Bruges, I was so taken with In Bruges when it came out, and I was like, where is Colin Farrell? Like, why don't we see more of him? And for a very long time, he was being very selective. You know, he would show up in one, maybe two films a year. He did not work often, and it was very clear that was not because he was having trouble getting work. It was because he was very, very selective about what he did. And to see him in this many movies with this much diversity is kind of exciting. That said, I don't want to entirely shift the focus off Martin McDonagh, who, you know, is just doing something. He is another filmmaker who I think has matured quite a bit. Our editor-in-chief, Chris Plant, wrote this pretty amazing, I think, look back at Martin McDonagh's plays and the fact that he wrote something like 10 plays over the course of a few months, and then it took a decade for them to actually all make it to the stage. He was just this like incredibly restless, driven young creator who threw a whole lot of stuff on the stage and then suddenly did a hard pivot into movies, but did not make many movies. And Chris ends up kind of like tracking the obsessions of his plays and how they work into his movies and the progression of the movies that he's made and how they've kind of shown him finding himself. And I think it's a pretty remarkable piece of analysis and criticism that I really enjoyed that really just made me think about Banshees in a different way. But we all ended up with this this one on our top 10. We were all pretty taken with it.
Yeah, it's really good. Tasha, what's your number three?
My number three is Rian Johnson's Glass Onion, which is a movie that has become just really surprising to me, pretty controversial and divisive on film Twitter. There are people that are big time angry with this movie because it's fluffy, and I certainly agree that it's fluffy. But man, it's been another year where I could use some fluff in my life. I loved the structure of Glass Onion so much. I love what it asks Janelle Monáe to do. I love how it kind of plays with the ideas that Rian Johnson first laid out in Knives Out, but just kind of makes them easier, I guess, easier on the eyes, easier on the brain. It's a sunny vacation movie that just kind of feels like maybe a little bit of comfort food in another complicated and stressful year. And the lightness of this movie and the silliness of this movie did not bother me at all. But I just wound up really loving the way that this thing is put together and what it asks you to follow Rian Johnson through. Just the loop-de-loops of time and the elements of the mystery involved, I found really compelling. I really like this cast. I like their silly, over-the-top characters. I just don't see a whole lot to dislike about Glass Onion, and I'm really surprised at the people who seem big-time mad about it.
I just ignore him, you know. And I'm with you. I love Glass Onion, and I love seeing it in the theater, which was sort of a weird 1 week window that Netflix did. But I mean, and it is fluffy in a sense. It's very entertaining, but I think it's got some bite to it too. I don't think it's the subtlest satire, but certainly satire is not is pretty central to what it's doing here as well.
Yeah, I mean, Knives Out took on deeper issues, headier issues, and in a more serious and subtle way. And that seems to be one of the big objections. But I don't know. Sometimes when you're looking at targets that are as ridiculous as this movie's targets are, I think it's fine to be a little ridiculous in response.
And it nails the target. I mean, and how can you not? How can you not love it? I mean, just like poking at billionaire idiots, it's just there's just no target that is richer than that. I find the film a great pleasure, and I mean, just to see it, this just like Knives Out, it's like you whodunits are the hardest thing to pull off. They just are. I mean, like, you just, the mechanics are hard to pull off. It's hard to both fool an audience and do it in a way where we don't feel cheated, and you just appreciate Johnson's ability to assemble all these pieces, because it's hard to do, and it's a pleasure. The structure, as you mentioned, is just a total delight and a surprise. And I don't know, I it's a weird thing to for people to kind of dismiss it as fluff, because I mean, why I don't know, what do you not like To Catch a Thief either? I mean, it's just like there's lots of movies that, you know, not everything has to be, you know, Psycho. It can be, you can have To Catch a Thief and be fine. So I had a good time with it, and I really enjoyed the podcast episode that we did, which was my first viewing also of The Last of Sheila, and it was kind of fun to see what he took away from that as well. So I'm a fan.
If I do have one regret in all of this top 10-ery that we're doing, it's that so many of the films on our top 10 lists are movies that we covered on the show. So we don't really have the chance to talk a bunch about movies that we haven't already talked about at great length. I did see other movies this year, y'all, but I think we're really pretty good at this point at looking ahead at a schedule and seeing.
Yeah,
sniffing out what movies are likely to be resonant to us. And of course, we cheat a fair bit. A lot of these movies we do see in advance and then say, okay, we just really have to make time on the show to talk about A Decision to Leave, or to talk about Banshees of Inisherin, or to talk about, you know, a lot of these other movies. So that is a little bit regrettable. And the other thing that is a little bit regrettable is that the two of you have the same two movies as your number one and number two, but in different orders. I think to prevent this discussion getting really constrained, I'm going to just completely break format here and say, Keith, why don't you tell us what your top two are? And then Scott, why don't you tell us what your top two are?
So my top two are, at number two, I have Tar, and number one, I have the film kind of rocketed to the top of my list after I saw it. And I thought, well, I'm glad I'm not going to have the same film that everybody else has. And then, of course, our friends, both hosts of Film Spotting, both have it as their number one film. I've seen it as number one film on other people's list. Anyways, After Sun, which is a remarkable debut film from Charlotte Wells. And a movie I keep coming back to with both of these. I keep coming back to individual scenes and kind of turning them over in my mind and thinking about how they fit into with the larger scheme of the film. But with After Sun, I think that's a film that just demands that of you, because it is so much about, it's a story we haven't, people who don't know, it's essentially the reflections of a filmmaker recalling a trip she took with her father, played by Paul Mescal, when she was 11 years old, to like kind of a budget Turkish resort, and you know, piecing together what happened, you know, a lot of unremarkable events events that seemed unremarkable at the time that kind of, you know, kind of fit into her understanding of who her father was and is, and it's one where it just doesn't, nothing really, it really comes together at the end. There's this, you know, incredible final stretch of scenes, but it's filled like of all kinds of, like, you know, lovely moments of observation along the way. I just love it, and I was not a film I even knew anything about at the beginning of the year. It came out of nowhere for me and blew me away. And Tar, you know, let's got to talk about Tar. It's his number one.
Yeah. Hey, wow. That, you want to break format. You spoil another man's number one.
Yeah.
But yeah, Scott, what are your top two?
It's the same as Keith, but reversed. My number two is After Sun. My number one is Tar. To get a little bit more on After Sun, I almost feel like, is this with both of the Film Spotting guys and with the two of us, Keith, is this a as a father of daughters choice?
It might be. It might be.
It was just an emotional, just a wrecking ball for me to watch this thing. And it was, just, and I, you know, it was, there's no film that came close, even after Yang didn't get the feels like this one did for me. And I think it has, there's something just about, you know, if you're about the way that parents, you know, have to, you know, sort of mask, I guess, the way that they're feeling a lot of the time when they're around their kids. They want their kids to be happy. They want to, in this case, as a father, wants to have, you know, show his kid a good time and do all the stuff in on a resort and be silly, and at the same time, you know, he's feeling obviously quite a lot of pain, and that dynamic and just the film's acknowledgement of that feeling of that reflection of just like, wait, this is who this person was, and you know even though he I don't know, it's just so touching, and just the way it works as a memory piece. I mean, you talk about it as a filmmaker reflecting on the past. I mean, that kind of is what it is, but it's not really framed that obviously, you know. I mean, it's not like a filmmaker is somebody who's a visible presence in the movie. It's just, it doesn't, it's not like the Fablemans or Armageddon right. time, and that
really only becomes apparent as the film goes along.
Exactly, well. Exactly. Yeah. It is a memory piece, but it doesn't behave like one. So that's really good. And as far as Tar is concerned, it's just the biggest movie I saw this year in terms of just having a richness to it, of having a bold, ambitious structure and style and tone and pace, of having a lead character who is so immensely complex and played, you know, really the performance of the year for me by Cate Blanchett. It is a film that approaches, you know, a big cultural issue without being an issue movie somehow. I don't know how it manages that, but it does. And I just think it just takes a lot of risks that pay off, you know. So it was a pretty clear number one for me in that respect. It had that kind of scope that you kind of want from a number one movie. Tar.
We already did talk about Tar at great length on its own episode, so I'm not going to get into that too much, except to say we're recording this in a very tight turnaround. It should be up. We're recording it on a Monday, and it's supposed to go up on a Tuesday. We'll see how our harried producer Genevieve handles that. But later this week, I think I got one more Tar piece in me that I'm going to get up at Polygon.com.
Really?
And it's definitely going to revolutionize film Twitter. People are definitely going to tell me that I'm an idiot. Anyway, as far as After Sun goes, after watching this movie, I kind of felt like I'd been poleaxed. The way it wraps, and the way that wrap invites you to reexamine everything that you've just seen. It's kind of a puzzle piece movie in a way. There are just so many threads to it that, you know, don't quite add up until the end as you put together the pieces. I think it's worth mentioning that it is a fictional movie. When you say it's a movie about a filmmaker looking back on her father, that is a fictional story about a fictional filmmaker looking back on her father. Mm. But writer-director Charlotte Wells is also a filmmaker who's using this movie to examine her relationship with her father. So, you know, it's a puzzle box inside a puzzle box in a way. But there have been so many movies in recent years that are documentaries about female filmmakers looking back on their fathers. It's, I guess, worth noting that just to try to give people a clearer view of it. I have said this before. I'm going to say it again. I strongly recommend immediately after watching After Sun, reading Sam Adams' analysis of the movie over on Slate, which really opened some things up for me in terms of how the movie uses some very specific symbols that are very, very subtle. You know, I think most Next Picture Show listeners are pretty attentive and analytical and thoughtful movie watchers, and they're going to get a lot of what this movie is laying down. But there are definitely some things that Sam caught that went completely over my head. And yeah. I loved that piece in terms of like observation and thought. It was one of the most useful critical pieces I think I read this year.
I endorse Sam Adams. I haven't read that piece, but Sam's great.
Another as a father of daughters guy. So
indeed.
Yeah, we love Sam. And it's crazy. We have not had Sam as a guest on the show. That's very strange. We should rectify that in 2023, because Sam's been a friend of mine for 20 years, and is an excellent critic, and can do pods quite well. So we should think about it.
A contributor at every place we've ever worked together. Yeah. Just a really
Rock
thoughtful
solid.
Critic in general.
Absolutely. Tasha,
put him on the list.
This is all you. You've got the floor for your number two and number one here.
Yeah, that's why I did this way, was just to give me more floor, because my number two requires a lot of floor. It requires a lot of space. It is, in fact, S.S. Rajamouli's RRR, the Indian Bollywood epic, more than 3 hours long, comes with an intermission. Is it a 3-act structure or a 12-act structure? I don't know. It's a lot of story. Uh-huh. It's a lot of story. But I loved this film, and I loved getting to see it in a theater, a completely sold out Music Box showing.
Oh my God, that would have been so much fun. I only saw
roughly 50% of the people there, by show of hands, had already seen the movie.
And oh wow,
were back for a second showing.
Oh my gosh.
Man, this the way people cheer the heroes in this movie, the way they boo-hissed the villains, the way they clapped along with the songs, it was a real experience. But even just watching it alone at home on Netflix, which is one of the places you can find it now, I have to think would be a pretty engaging experience, albeit one that some people might want to approach like TV and just watch it episodically, because there's so many movements to this story. It's the story of two soulmates who are also both big time Indian action stars, to the point where the two of them appearing in a movie together was a big deal in its native country. But it's also been an international super hit just because it's so damn fun. The two characters meet during a sequence where they see a child in danger, they lock eyes from afar, and then they engage in a thoroughly ridiculous scheme to save the child that involves fire and swinging off of bridges and explosions and national flags flying triumphantly in the breeze and a horse and a motorcycle at the same time. This whole movie is just full of ludicrous action set pieces, CGI enhanced. There's no pretense of this movie being about gritty, grounded realism. It's just all over the top, like big time fun. And the best bromance, I think, to come to the screen in 2022. This movie is just a riot. I'm surprised that neither of you guys put it on your top tens. Oh, what did you see it? What did you think?
Yeah, I wrote a big piece on it for the reveal. I think I just had like some reservations about the politics of it. Kind of, it just felt a little
fair.
Bit. I mean, it's kind of very much a sort of broadly nationalistic film, which I guess is what Hero is too, in a way that the Zhang Yimou film, which is awesome as well. So maybe I'm being too hard on it, but because it is you know, on a surface level, unbelievably pleasurable. I mean, just it is such a treat. I would have loved to have seen it in a theater with an enthusiastic audience, because it is made for that experience. And I'm kind of curious about maybe introducing my eldest daughter to it, so she can kind of get a sense of what a movie can do, because this movie does so much. It's got it all, you know. And I you know, that just the sequence of the dance sequence with the suspenders is just, oh my God, it's so good.
I have just shown that sequence at this point to three different people, and anybody else I can find that hasn't seen RRR that I'm trying to sell on RRR, I just show them that.
All you need to do, or even a shot of somebody throwing a tiger at somebody is probably good enough.
Yeah, what I've shown people is the first meeting between our two heroes, where they sort of instantly lock eyes and bond with the set. I was like, these people have not met before. I think this movie's a lot of fun. I don't know what's holding me back from being it's not a top 10 for me. I think part of it is, something like Scott touched on, is that final sequence where you realize, oh wait, I think I've been watching a propaganda film. I don't really fully understand what the propaganda is supporting here, but whatever. I'm that unease maybe overstated.
Yeah, maybe just not really knowing the history involved. Like, these two men are portraying just like comedically superheroized versions of real Indian nationalists. And the closing number is a big Indian nationalist like independence thing. And the villains in this movie are the British Raj, and they are boo-hiss evil to the super extreme.
To be clear, I have no issue with that. if anything, understate it.
When I saw it at the Music Box, it was because the director had come to town and was being interviewed by Katie Reif, who I'm delighted to say saw the movie because of me, because I sent her to review it before anybody knew it was going to be a giant hit here. And one of the questions she asked him was, how did this movie play in England? And he's like, they loved it. It's a huge hit there. It's made a ton of money. So I think the Brits, at least some of them, have a sense of humor about the whole thing. But yeah, it's hard for me to take this as political agitprop, not knowing enough about the individual historical elements at play here. Like I actually went and read up on a lot of it afterwards, but I know it's so outside my experience that it's hard for me to criticize one of the most fun films of the year for, you know, messaging that is not aimed at me and that I don't get. Maybe that's a lazy way of looking at things. I don't know. It's certainly something I'm gonna have to think about more.
I mean, a pleasure is a pleasure. So Tasha, I don't think there was never any question in my mind for months what would be your number one film. So please, what was your favorite film to 2022?
I mean, I kept an open mind for the rest of the year. I was ready for something to come along and nudge this film out of the top 10, but nope, just never happened. Everything Everywhere All at Once. The Daniels remain two of my favorite filmmakers, two of my favorite people, just their thoughtfulness and their weird combination of soulful, like pro-humanistic messaging and weird butt humor. You know, the jokes about stuff, people gaining superpowers by sticking stuff up their butts is just never going to be my area per se. I'm not a butt humor kind of person. And the way they managed to sell it just really, really lands for me. Everything Everywhere All at Once is one of these mega maximalist films that, you know, I love in part because it challenges me to keep up. You know, it challenges me to take in and accept and learn new things about an invented cosmos that happens so rapidly. You know, you blink and you're going to miss something. But it's also a funny movie. It's also a soulful movie. It's a thoughtful movie. It's a philosophical movie. It's a ridiculously ambitious movie. It's a dumb as hell martial arts movie. It's just all of these things. And I said that I maybe thought about Nope more than any other movie this year, but I definitely wrote more about Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah, how much got written just by you for this movie?
I mean, if nothing else, I interviewed Daniels, and I ended up probably getting three or four pieces out of that interview alone, just because the ideas were so so diverse. You know, so many different things came out of that because they're doing so much here. And it's amazing to me that this movie, the big, loud, heartful complexity of this movie really all just kind of comes down to like, hey, people, be kind to each other. Could you maybe be a little kinder? And I'm given to understand that some of the fans of this movie started getting nasty to critics on social media when top 10 lists started dropping and this movie wasn't on them. And Daniel Kwan, one of the writer-directors, stood up and posted a rant on Twitter that was basically, did you watch the movie? The whole point of the movie is be kind. Please stop doing this. Mm-hmm. Like, the movie was a massive hit. It's made more money than any A24 movie ever. And one of the things he said was, you know, top 10 lists drive people's attention to movies they might not otherwise have seen and help smaller movies get made. We don't need the help, you know, just celebrate some of these small movies that are making the top 10 lists and go watch them and don't be nasty to other people in our names. I love these dudes. I love how they approach the world. I love how they approach filmmaking. I love the performances. I love that they went out and found an actor who gave up acting 20 years ago because the industry was so bad and gave him a platform. Just like everything about Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think was designed for my DNA. And I can't help but love it. It's unquestionably my top film of 2022.
It's really good. It landed at like number 12 for me, but it's I think it's remarkable for all the reasons that you point out. It's also I need to see it again. I think what held me back a little bit is like I was worn out by it. About, you know, it exhausted me at a certain point. Although I loved everything it was doing, it just I was just like, can you just slow down just a little.
Less of
I don't
it.
Know. Yeah, I guess, but that's not maximalist then, is it?
No. Yeah, this movie is not called Many Things, Many Places.
Yes, yeah, I know. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's really good. And I think it's going to be one of the defining films of the year. I mean, it's like that I think the three films that are absolutely going to be, you know, keep the discussion going about this year are going to be Tar, Everything Everywhere All at Once, and Nope. I think those are the ones people are just going to keep coming back to and talking about, even if they're not necessarily my 1, 2, and 3 of the year.
Yeah, there is certainly a gap, I think, sometimes in our top 10 lists as we try to sort out the difference between our favorite movies of the year, the most ambitious movies of the year, the most technically perfect movies of the year, the most like unassailably thought through movies of the year. They're not always the same things. And juggling them around on top 10 lists does sometimes feel like comparing apples, oranges, bananas, and Sherman tanks. So, you know, we do our best with these lists. They reflect how we're feeling in the moment that we make them. We may feel different, 2 weeks down the line. We may see something 2 weeks down the line from 2022 that we missed earlier and deeply regret it. But we do the best we can, and we've done the best we can here. Anything else you two want to say before we close this out?
I agree with Keith's point about Everything Everywhere All at Once, Nope, and Tar definitely feel like conversations that will continue, and also Confess Fletch.
2022 will remember it as the year of Confess Fletch.
Yes, exactly.
Well, 2023 is going to be remembered as the year of Megan, the horror film about an evil robotic doll. So that's what we're taking up with our next pairing. Of course, we looked at that movie and immediately thought of Child's Play, the movie that started the Chucky series. We felt that it was just high time that we took up an evil doll movie pairing for the first time here. January may be looking a little thin for movies like Tar that we consider like epic experiences that we're going to be analyzing and talking about for a long time. So we decided to just kind of like drop back and look at what's looking like one of the bigger, sillier, funner releases of the first couple of weeks of January. So if you want to play along, that's what our next two-part episode is going to be on, Child's Play and Megan. This has been a very informally structured and mostly on the wing top 10 of 2022 list. And I think we're going to all go see Megan now. Looking forward to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is it's just the perfect kind of like you've been just intensely watching like the most important films of the year. And then you immediately shift gears into killer doll movie. So, yeah, I'm excited.
Well, as always, we appreciate it when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations with us. We want to hear what your top 10s are. We want to hear what we left off, what we missed, what you can't believe we put on these lists in the first place. If you want to write in or call, we might feature your response on a future episode. Leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Before we close out this top 10, where can we find everyone these days? Keith?
I'm a freelance writer. I'm on Twitter at KFIP3000. I write for some places like GQ, The Ringer, Vulture, TV Guide, and The Reveal, which is the newsletter that Scott and I write together, thereveal.substack.com. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff from both of us there. Scott, how about you? Where can we find you?
Same. I'm on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. With The Reveal, we are running our top 10 lists. Their top 15 lists and other stuff. These are big features are running this week on Tuesday and Wednesday. If you're hearing this podcast, then you can run over and check those out. Also, if you are a paid subscriber to The Reveal, we just also launched our inaugural readers poll, subscriber poll. So you can kind of take a look at, if you're a subscriber, then you can kind of participate in that. I'm pretty excited about what results that will yield. And then you can find my work in other places like New York Times and Guardian and other such outlets. Tasha?
You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. I am the film and streaming editor at Polygon.com, where you can find my lengthy interview with Park Chan-wook about Decision to Leave. You can find Chris Plant talking analytically and thoughtfully about Banshees of Inisherin and Martin McDonagh's career. And later this week, you can find me being very, very silly about Tar. Our absent producer, Genevieve Kosky, is the TV editor over at Vulture. She is on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod. You can get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Baked Jakes for his rush assistance in producing this very long podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.